It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You'll be happy to know the Supreme Court said today that your genes, that's G-E-N-E-S, are indeed your own, but there is still money to be made from them. And on our series Consumed today, the flip side of all that buying we do, savings from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Thursday, the 13th of June. Good as always to have you with us. Consumed is coming up, our series on the consumer economy and us. First, though, a detour through the human genome to get us going. The Supreme Court ruled today that corporations may not, in fact, patent human genes. The specific genes at issue were the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. They were in the news a couple of weeks ago with Angelina Jolie, if you recall, because they can help determine whether a woman has an increased chance of developing breast or ovarian cancer. It is obviously an intensely personal diagnosis, but the ruling today, though, is decidedly industrial. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on the $65 billion genomics industry.
For companies that rely on patenting human genes to make products like genetic tests for cancer, the court's decision is disastrous. Art Kaplan is the director of ethics at NYU's Medical Center.
This is a major decision. It's kind of a tsunami that's going to move through the biotech industry.
Kaplan says the tsunami will destroy companies that don't innovate, that don't pivot quickly, and start making products with genes they've changed to make synthetic materials, which the court ruled can be patented. Juan Enriquez heads Excel Venture Management, a biotech venture capital firm. He says lots of companies are already doing this, using synthetic material to make everything from food to biofuels.
So you can design cells so they begin producing specific fuels or specific chemicals.
And now that human genes can't be patented, researchers will have more access to them. It'll be cheaper for patients to have their genetic codes mapped out. Edward Abrahams heads the Personalized Medicine Coalition. He says your doctor could look at your genetic code to decide how much medicine and which medicine to give you.
If you have a certain genetic profile, whether drug A or B, C, or is going to work for you.
Abraham says the Supreme Court case did create winners and losers, but consumers should come out on the winning side with lots of new biotech products just over the horizon. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
In Turkey today, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is meeting with protesters from Taksim Square and Gezi Park. There is talk of a referendum over there now to decide whether the park stays or goes. Goes as in gets bulldozed and has a shopping mall built on it. Erdogan has said he'd respect the outcome of that vote, but he also said today that he wants protesters out, lickety-split. Our patience is at an end, he said. I'm making my warning for the last time. That's a quote. Later today, the protesters said they're staying on anyway. The BBC's Nkem Ifejica is on the line with us from Istanbul. Hello, Nkem.
Hey, Kai, how are you?
I'm good. So listen, this whole thing started with, at bottom, an economic protest, right? The plans to build a mall on Gezi Park. We have now come full circle to where there are protests and boycotts being talked about of some of the big companies over there. The prime minister is accusing the protesters of trying to actively damage the Turkish economy. What's actually going on the ground?
It's quite astonishing. We got here on Tuesday, and you know, we're just business reporters. We're here to do the business, but of course, you're trying to have something as simple as lunch, and you've got tear gas in your face, which, and I must say, if you haven't experienced tear gas before, they call it tear gas for a reason. Tears streaming down your eyes, your nose watering. But on the ground, it's, as you said, it's mushroomed from what was just something about a park. So something which is about much more than that. It's about civil liberties. It's about how people live their lives in Turkey.
Does this break down at all on along the lines of social economy? Do you have the business class supporting the prime minister and younger people and trade unions supporting the protesters? How does it break down?
I've spoken to people who are just sort of ordinary white-collar workers who go to work in the daytime and then join the protesters at Gezi Park at night. Huh. At the same time, you have members of the business community who like what the Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has done over the past 10 years. He rescued them from a crisis. Just on Tuesday, figures came out about the growth rate first quarter of this year, 3%. President Obama would give a limb to have that sort of growth rate. So there's a sense here that people want things to get back to normal. But there's a subtext to all of this as well. The people, to a certain extent, have economic freedom. But it appears that what they want now is political freedom. And at the moment, it seems that especially the young people, they're saying, you know what, yes, we've got money in our pockets, but we also don't want you to tell us what to do with that money, as it were.
Which way does the Turkish economy want to go? You know, a couple of years ago, the big thing over there was we're going to join the European Union, and that's what we really want to do. But then the other part of that economy turns to the other side, and it goes to Libya and to Syria. What's the tendency, do you think?
Well, to use a sort of old Silicon Valley phrase, it's about pivoting. It's a pivot. That's exactly what it is. Over the past few years, as the Eurozone has slumbered and faltered, they're looking elsewhere for their bread. They're not going to wait for the European Union to pick up, because who knows when that's going to happen. No doubt there will be advantages from joining the European Union, but there are bigger markets out there as well. There's China, there's India. It makes sense for them to look to other places.
If I went to Istanbul today and got, I don't know, 2 miles, 5 miles away from Taksim Square and Gezi Park, would I even know any of this is going on? Could I go out and buy a loaf of bread and go to a cafe unmolested?
You could go out and buy a loaf of bread, but the thing is, if you sort of went by, bought your loaf of bread and sat in the cafe, chances are it would not be as busy as it was. Families are not going out, for example, and it's not because anything is going to happen to them. It's because there's a sense of fear. Nobody likes instability, least of all investors. So if investors are pulling out, then that spells problems.
Nkem Efecica for the BBC in Istanbul. Nkem, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Speaking of investors, there wasn't any pulling out today on Wall Street. Everybody was jumping in. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're going to pick up now with Consumed, our series this week from our sustainability desk.
We want more. We want more.
Here's how to order.
Now, how much would you pay?
But you can see it's worth it.
Call now, because you're worth it, worth it, worth it.
What we're talking about this week is whether we can afford our kind of consumer behavior in the long run. What we get for all the buying that we do and what it costs. One decision we're always making is, should we spend now or should we spend later? In other words, how much should we save? Today, in particular, how much should we save for retirement and how should we do that? Marketplace's Scott Tong explains how retirement became a do-it-yourself kind of thing.
Introducing the father of the 401k. Ted Benna is a decidedly un-Wall Street kind of guy. He grew up on a Pennsylvania dairy farm.
My dad did a great thing for me there. I had my own cow when I was 7 years old, and we got paid a little money from that.
Hard work and thrift is Ted Benna's answer to a world full of stuff to buy. He spent his career planning people's retirements. So I figure, hey, I'll show him my 401k, get some free advice.
Yes, it appears you get a dollar for dollar match. Does that sound right? Well, that's super.
A bit of small talk yields quickly to a lecture. It turns out I'm drowning in fees.
You are in investments that are more expensive.
You're talking about the fees.
That you don't see.
Benna has one main beef with the system. It's too complicated.
Well, when you have one, two, three, four, five.
In my case, he says 20 investment choices is too many. But wait, this is the father of the 401k.
Hey, I'd blow up the existing structure and start over.
What's he mean? Well, to understand, let's back up to the accidental rise of the 401k. Let's go back to the 60s and 70s. Back then, if you worked for a big company and you retired, you got a pension, a regular check. Bennett helped to run these plans. He was a consultant. And in the late 70s, he was unhappy.
Most of what I was doing was working with business owners. Their main interest was, how can I get the biggest tax break and give the least to my employees legally?
Then Bennett says inspiration came from two very different places. God, he's a religious man, and the Internal Revenue Code. It was 1978. Congress passed an obscure add-on to Tax Code Section 401.
I added this little paragraph K, and I still have, you know, original copy. It was about a page and a quarter long. That's all it was.
401k was an unassuming tax break for companies letting workers put away some cash on the side. Only the tax nerds noticed. Until divine inspiration hit Benna.
Well, how about adding a match, an additional incentive? Immediately, I jumped to, wow, this is a big deal.
His concoction was effectively a bribe for workers. They got extra money from the boss and a tax break if they took some of their own paycheck and set it aside for retirement.
The biggest benefit of 401k is it converts them from spenders to savers. It enables them to do something they wouldn't do on their own.
Bennett had a hunch that 401ks would take off. Indeed, they did in the early 80s. Big companies offered them first, and in the meantime, they started to ditch their pension plans, which were expensive. And before long,
401k became very popular for little companies to have that never had any retirement program.
Thus began the era of make your own retirement. The American worker now faced a choice: spend my whole paycheck or take the employer match slash bribe and start to save. It made for some tension.
Now you go home to your spouse and she says, are you nuts? I mean, look, the end of the month, we got nothing left. I mean, how are you going to put 6% of your pay in? But you say, well, look, my company's going to give me 3%. I'm crazy if I don't do this.
By the mid-90s, 30 million Americans had 401k plans. Do-it-yourself retirement seemed easy in the decade's bull market. We know what came next in 2000. That's when the dot-com bubble burst. Then, in the financial crisis, the average 401k plan lost 27%.
Unfortunately, the worst thing that happened with this wretched market is too many people had the highest stock ownership that they ever had at the wrong time.
Today, the typical middle-class household nearing retirement has saved $120,000. That's about one-tenth what many say it needs. And for all the 401k growth, about half of all workers still have no plan. Has the system failed us? I asked Ted Bennett that today. He's thought a lot about that. It's almost like his creation got overtaken by events. He never meant for the explosion and all the confusing investment choices. The original plans offered two. It was never Ted Bennett's idea for do-it-yourself to replace pensions. It just kind of happened.
This is kind of the whole enchilada, you know.
What's your thought on it now having become the whole enchilada?
Well, it's not good, but it's reality.
Bennett says the 401k was never meant to take care of everyone. It was simply a financial product that took off. And it did help middle-income Americans, tens of millions of them.
What makes the U.S. different and has historically is a strong middle class. Doesn't matter what your society is, you're always going to have your top and you're going to have plenty on the bottom, unfortunately. The key is what is going to be in the middle and what financial condition are they going to be in.
And if the 401k has done anything, creator Ted Bennett argues it's forced a whole lot of thrift into household economics. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The idea was land values will go up as schools and roads and county courthouses go in, and we will then sell at a profit and move on elsewhere.
My, oh my, where have we heard that before? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials had its first winning day of the week today, gained 180 points, 1.2%, closed at 15,176. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 1.3%, 3,445 at the bell. The S&P 500 regained itself 23 points, 1.5%, finished at 1,636. The biggest winners in the saving for retirement race could be the mutual funds and money managers that hold trillions in 401ks and IRAs. BlackRock is the biggest asset manager with nearly $4 trillion. BlackRock shares up 1.25% today. Franklin Templeton includes two of the oldest mutual fund companies, Franklin and Templeton. Ticker name, by the way, the ticker symbol, B-E-N, Ben, as in Franklin. Climbed 2.6% today. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for May. Time to display that red, white, and blue. It's Flag Day, commemorating the adoption of the Stars and Stripes as the country's official flag. And the 10th annual Avon Heritage Duct Tape Festival gets underway in Ohio. 3 whole days to tape stuff together. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is what we're told to do as consumers in this economy. Buy houses to pursue the American dream. Take on debt if we need to. Buy things to help the economy and at the same time, save for the future. A recent report from one mutual fund company spelled out in plain bullet-pointed English everything we need to do to retire comfortably. It's easy. Here you go. Start saving when you're 25. Save continuously until you're 67. Never get sick, pregnant, or laid off. And get a raise each and every year. That's what you call easy comedy pickings right there, people. Liz Winstead, who helps start The Daily Show, is here to help us out with that. Liz, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
So listen, when you were 25, what were you doing? Were you planning for retirement?
I have to tell you, when I was 25, I was planning on trying to maybe not sell plasma to pay off my student loans.
Right, right. Exactly. Which gets us to the absurdity of this situation, right? They're talking about people having to start at the age of 25 to save for retirement. Come on.
It's Narnia. I think they actually interviewed people who live in Narnia. And when you read the article, they have this hypothetical woman named Lily, mm-hmm. who, you know, never gets sick. She works nonstop. She never gets laid off. I just grew to resent this fake person, Lily, who's never had a hardship in her life. Yeah. But they do base it on such a set of hypotheticals that I don't know one single person has lived.
There's some economic modeling that goes into all this stuff, right? It's you know, your salary increases 1.5% a year. There's inflation at 2.3% a year. All of which is to point out that nobody knows what they're talking about, right? Because a day after tomorrow, you know, J.P. Morgan could go broke again and it'd be all over.
That's exactly right. And so it's all kind of a whole bunch of hocus pocus, smoke and mirrors. And basically what I think the economic model that we all that live in the reality-based community look at is yeah. working 3 jobs. You know, you might retire, but then you're working at one of the fine dignity-saving jobs that you get when you're 70, you know, Walmart greeter, you know, mall Santa, Pope. Mm-hmm. I think those are the big 3. This is the new plan. Maybe you retire from 25 to 45. And then you actually yeah, work from 45
to
90.
To work.
That's my new plan.
I like that. That's actually pretty good. How do you plan for your retirement? I mean, what do you do? Do you sock money under your pillow or something?
Well, you know, the good news for us little joke tellers is that we can have arthritis and tell jokes. We can be crippled and tell jokes. You know, we can be sick and tell jokes. I kind of plan on observing the world for as long as I can take breath into my body because I have a feeling as long as people are writing articles like this, I am going to have job security.
Liz Winstead, Air America Radio, The Daily Show. She's got her own book out. It's called Liz Free or Die. Liz,
it gives no financial advice at all.
No financial advice at all, just like funny stuff. Liz, yes. Thanks a bunch.
Thanks.
All right, so continuing now with our series Consumed. There is no small part of this consumer economy that operates on faith, believing that things are going to keep on getting better. There kind of has to be that optimism, even after the financial crisis we had, because otherwise, what is there? But even when you've got a bubble, like we had a housing bubble, a big, giant, dangerous housing bubble, only a handful of people recognize it. Everybody else is just keeping up, buying and buying some more, and then, bam, it's all over. Like most of history, what happened to us has happened before. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner went to the high plains of Montana to report on a little-known bubble from a century ago.
Finally, they came to a rich, fertile valley. And with deep thanks and prayer for their safety, they began their new life.
Okay, cut the schmaltz. This isn't that kind of pioneer story. This one you might call the homestead swindle. It's got scheming corporations, greedy bankers, and wide-eyed American dreamers. All the characters in this story are dead now, but a few of their voices are preserved on tape.
When I came out, the train was loaded with people coming to Homestead. People were just going crazy. It was just like a gold rush, I suppose.
That was pioneer Lillian Stevenson. A museum in Billings, Montana, interviewed her a few decades back because Lillian, well, she was part of one of the most dramatic and contrived real estate booms in American history. You see, she and over 80,000 others swarmed to Montana in the 1910s. The bait? Well, it was sort of like the early 20th century version of a zero-down mortgage. It was free land, 320 acres under the Homestead Act. And to a lot of folks back then, that offer sounded like a no-brainer.
Especially Scandinavians, Germans coming from Europe with absolutely nothing and seeing an opportunity to establish themselves out west on what for them must have seemed like a kingdom.
Derek Strawn, he's a historic preservationist in Bozeman. Strawn says railroad tycoons like the Great Northern's James Hill, they lobbied Congress like today's K Street pros to get the homestead law expanded.
They were desperate to get people settling here so that they could capitalize on freight rates and that sort of thing.
300 acres on three conditions: build a house, grow some crops, and stay for at least 3 years. The railroads would subsidize your train fare to Montana. Heck, they'd even sell you some of their land for cheap. And the banks, oh, they were more than happy to lend you lots of money, even if you were dirt poor or didn't know a tractor from a tin can.
To have major corporations and to have the U.S. government saying, we want you to do this, we will provide incentives that make it possible for you. People listened to that and they thought to themselves, how can we go wrong?
Sounds scarily familiar? What followed was irrational exuberance, nearly a century before Alan Greenspan coined the term. And just like during our housing bubble, there were good reasons to feel exuberant. For one, there'd been plenty of rain. Montana wheat was winning top prize at national competitions, and farmers were getting top price for it. Billings historian Kevin Koistra.
All of these things are kicking in and lending itself to that sense of optimism.
Outright propaganda fueled the boom, too.
This has always been a droughty country. The railroad put out a lot of false information about, oh, man, it was just great out here.
Dale Brown is retired in the tiny town of Terry, Montana, but his family still owns and ranches on his grandpa's homestead, about a half hour outside Terry.
The wind is nasty.
Trees are in short supply here. It's all buttes and broad rolling grasslands.
Up on the hill right through that gate is where grandpa's first house was. And then over there you can see that silver pipe sticking up out of the ground. That was their first water well.
Brown's heard all the stories, how the railroads hired the madmen of their day to help lure people here, the advertising that made Montana look like lush English countryside.
There was one difference between eastern Montana and the desert in Arizona, one snowstorm.
In fact, 320 acres of this second-rate soil, it wasn't nearly enough to make a living. But Dale's grandpa lived in a time of what now sound like superstitious beliefs, like the idea that the mere act of farming the land would bring more rain. Sort of like the belief, just a few years ago, that housing prices will always go up. And both of those myths attracted speculators. David Wishart, a Great Plains geographer, says forget Little House on the Prairie. Many of the Montana homesteaders weren't looking to stay.
The idea was land values will go up as schools and roads and county courthouses go in, and we will then sell at a profit and move on elsewhere. It was all a process of capitalizing on cheap land.
But just like housing prices fell in 2008, the rains here stopped. World War I ended and grain prices fell. Drought set back in and stuck. Farms started foreclosing, banks went belly up. By the middle of the 1920s, over 90% of those wide-eyed dreamers were gone, and they left with no assets, no nest egg, no nothing. Some ended up clinging to the sides of the train, desperate to flee Montana. Pioneer Lillian Stevenson, the one on tape, she told her interviewer the only reason she didn't skip town and go back to her native Missouri.
I didn't have the money to buy a ticket.
Otherwise, you'd have gone back.
I'd have went back. If I'd have had the money to buy a ticket, I'd have been gone, same as the others. I'd have gone.
If you ask people in Montana now, they'll tell you the whole homesteading scheme had a snowflake's chance in hell of succeeding. This droughty part of the country could never have supported all those homesteaders the railroads enticed here. Of course, that's the same kind of thing we all say today, in hindsight, about the housing market crash. In eastern Montana, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
So forget Montana. In this housing market here, is buying a home worth it or not? Play our game, Worth It or Not, it's called, and vote, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which I read on my phone as I was on my way back to the office with a fresh cup of coffee, I kid you not. I guess this has been out there for a while and I just missed it, but the new edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, kind of the Bible for mental health disorders in this country, now lists caffeine withdrawal. To quote the Wall Street Journal, things become mental disorders when they impair a person's ability to function in daily life, which is kind of true for me and not getting my coffee, which is also kind of sad, but that's a whole different thing. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM today. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.